The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. From gluten-free versus gluten's fine to the margarine versus butter debate, navigating nutrition science is like sailing without a compass. It's hard to know which direction will land you on solid ground. Line up the studies and you'll often find competing results. Wine and coffee, for example, have both been found to lower and heighten your risk of getting cancer. If nutrition is a science, why is it so hard to figure out what's good for you and what's bad? Well, the data geeks at 538 have an answer. Christy Ashwanden is 538's lead science writer. She recently wrote about why nutrition science is so hard to pin down, and in the process discovered some dubious correlations of her own. Virginia asked Christy how researchers usually track the food habits of their subjects.
The normal way that food habits are tracked in research is with something called a food frequency questionnaire, or FFQ. This is the most common way that people try to figure out what people are eating. And what it is a survey that asks people, there can be different timelines, but a common one would be, over the last 6 months, how often did you eat potato chips, say? And when you ate potato chips, you know, how much did you eat and how often? And so, you know, based on people's answers to things like this, that's how you get correlations like in our study, we found that potato chip eating was correlated with a high math score on the SAT.
You tried to keep one of these FFQs of your own. Do you think you kept an accurate count?
It was really difficult. I would say that I don't trust my answers. After taking the FFQ, it sort of spits out an assessment of your diet, what you're eating, how many calories, what sorts of nutrients you're getting, and whatnot. And the FFQ told me that my three top sources of calories were cheese, full fat, mm-hmm. both red and white wine, and oatmeal. But things that you eat less often, then the accuracy is going to really go down. You know, I know that most mornings I have a bowl of oatmeal, and so I'm pretty sure about that. But when you ask me about something like cantaloupe or lemonade or bananas, things that I eat sometimes but not a lot, you know, I found myself often as I was taking the test thinking, well, I don't really know, and really feeling like I was guessing.
Well, I guess what one of the things I got from your article was that coming up with portion size or measurements is really a tricky business.
It really is. And I think, you know, I've talked in the past with researchers who study obesity and are trying to help people lose weight. And one of the problems is it's really hard for people to measure serving sizes. You know, it's easy if you're at home and maybe you're using a scale or you're eating something that comes in sort of a discrete packet or something like that. But otherwise, it can be really difficult. One of the questions on the food frequency questionnaire that we took asked, how often do you eat cheese? And, you know, how many slices do you eat? And a lot of the cheese that it turned out that we were eating doesn't really come in slices,
right?
Or doesn't, you know, we think of it more in chunks. And, you know, how big is a slice? I don't know.
I can understand that. But using this food frequency questionnaire, you did some experimenting to see how easy it is to find these links between individual foods and some possible health factors, like you mentioned potato chips and being good at math. What are some of the other correlations you found, and how do you come up with them?
Yeah, so what we did is we recruited some readers to take the FFQ as well. The FFQ, after someone takes it, spits out this enormous set of data, different variables that you can then look at. And so we paired that with a little quiz that my colleague Walt Hickey sort of came up with. And we asked them about all sorts of things, what religion they were, whether they had a dog or a cat, if they'd had a weird rash in the last year, whether the film Crash deserved to win Best Picture. So some sort of silly things. And so the food frequency questionnaire itself produced over 1,000 variables. models that we could then test against the 26 different characteristics, like, you know, what you thought of the movie Crash, that we could compare them against. And so what it did was almost ensured that we would come up with some spurious correlations. And in fact, in our calculations, we found that we should expect at least 1,300 false positives. So it was extremely easy to find things that weren't real.
So just out of curiosity, what were the correlations with the movie Crash?
People who drank lemonade believed that Crash deserved to win Best Picture, but iced tea lovers didn't like Crash.
Also see correlations between eating raw tomatoes and Judaism.
I think my favorite one is that people who trim the fat from their steaks were more likely to be atheists than the people that, you know, ate the fat that God had provided for them.
And this is from the 538 blog. I mean, isn't this all about what data can reveal about us? The aggregator that accurately predicted the 2008 presidential election. How on earth did you come up with these?
Yeah, we just sort of use the same sort of techniques that are used in these nutrition studies. So what they do is, let's say you're interested in cancer and you want to know, are there foods that might be correlated with cancer? Recently, earlier last year, there were some studies that came out looking at meat consumption and cancer, for instance. And so they give a bunch of people the food frequency questionnaires and then sort of sort them into how much meat they're eating and how often, et cetera. And then they look at, you know, who gets cancer and is cancer more common in the people that are eating more meat versus the ones that are eating less. And so this is really sort of the technique that's used. And the problem is that, you know, first of all, correlation is not causation. So very frequently when these studies are reported in the media, you'll see a headline like foods that fight cancer or you know, something like that, that's implying causation. Mm-hmm. These studies just cannot prove causation. They can only suggest.
So eating table salt does not really connect that strongly with the positive relationship with an internet service provider, as you found.
Probably not. And I mean, if you think about it for a second, you know, let's say it's completely possible that correlation is real. That's another important thing to understand, that it may be that these things are correlated, but it doesn't mean that they're causal. So if you don't like your internet or cable provider, you know, putting more salt on your food probably isn't going to help, you know, but it may be that people who eat more salt, you know, tend to watch more TV and the salt's coming from, you know, salty snacks that they're eating while watching television and, you know, et cetera. So there are reasons that something might be correlated, which do not then translate into actionable things that people can do in the way that it's so often presented.
Well, Christy, do you think we're so desperate to know what kind of effect food has on our bodies that on some level we may know these studies offer a simplistic picture, but maybe choose to believe them anyway?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think most reasonable people understand that, you know, eating more of a particular fruit isn't going to allow them to live forever, right? Right. You know, if eating some particular food really could have your chance of getting cancer, we would all be doing it and it would be a huge public health good. But one of the problems is when they present these results, they're so often presented as relative risks instead of absolute risks. And so that really seems to inflate the effects. But I think fundamentally what we're seeing here is that, you know, scary things happen to people. You get sick, people that were previously healthy develop cancer. And, you know, when these sorts of things happen, the first impulse that we have is to look for a way to protect ourselves or a reason why that's not going to happen to us. And food is one thing that we can actually control as opposed to all these other factors. So I think it's just a natural human reaction to want to control this one thing. And it's sort of a way of trying to get a sense of agency over, you know, impending death, which we can't stop, right?
Christy Ashwandin is lead science writer at 538. You can find a link to her article, You Can't Trust What You Read About Nutrition. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And now from dubious food science to straight-up food fiction. Whether they're plugging enormous, juicy fast-food burgers or perfectly plated enchiladas, we've all seen food advertisements on TV, menus, and billboards that look too good to be true. And that is, of course, because they are. Virginia spoke with Angelina Chapin, who is the blog's editor at The Huffington Post and a contributor to The Guardian, where she recently wrote the article, WD-40 and Microwaved Tampons, Secrets of Food Photography Revealed.
So I think we can't go any further without explaining that title.
Right.
So, microwave tampons? What?
Yeah. So obviously we pull out the most interesting bits for that headline, and those certainly qualify as them. WD-40 is something that one of the food stylists who does a lot of Mexican cuisine told me about. So she sort of sprays the meats and the enchiladas, kind of the outside of any kind of food she's working on, to give it a brown, juicy, glistening sheen. And then the tampons are actually to create steam. So, for example, if you have a bowl of pasta that has that nice kind of mountain fog coming up over it, that's because a tampon has been wet with water, microwaved, and then embedded somewhere either in or beside the pasta.
I'm not sure I want to know these things.
I know. It's a very weird image, that one.
Well, so you spoke with a number of food stylists for this piece.
Yes.
What does like an average food shoot entail?
Well, it's quite long, so it kind of reminded me of maybe being on a film set or something, where they actually start early in the morning and it kind of goes for 10 or 12 hours.
What?
Yeah, so there's, and you know, they might not be shooting just one ad. It could be a series of ads. There's a couple of moving parts, right? So there's the photographer, and then there's the stylist who are working together, and then they've got all their assistants and aides running around to get everything prepared. But the stylist would have a kit that he or she brings to set and materials ready, depending on what commercial or ad they're shooting for. And then they sort of just get to work setting the food up. Often they have to cook. Often they have to chop or make a dish from scratch. A big part of it is improvisation. So there's sort of two parts to why they use food that isn't real. One is that, you know, mashed potatoes might just look better as a milkshake in an ad because of it's an easier material to work with and they can style it in the exact way. But another reason is because real ice cream could melt, or they could be working with a steak that has freezer burn on it and doesn't look good, so they have to bring in something else quick. So it's kind of an issue of always thinking on their feet, which is why one stylist told me all of a sudden her client wanted coffee and they didn't have that on set, and they're under extreme time pressure. They're paying big dollars for this, so she just grabbed some soy sauce and watered it down.
You mentioned mashed potatoes, which is another sort of go-to trick that you mentioned. How do they use mashed potatoes besides as a shake?
Yeah, in all sorts of ways, but the main thing is for stuffing. So you think mashed potatoes is actually the most essential thing in a stylist's toolkit because they're easy to make. They use instant mashed potatoes, and they're easy to mold. So you take an enchilada, for example, rather than have to cook up the vegetables, get all the meat going, and have it be the perfect shape, they just kind of use this filling that's very malleable. So it can also be used as the base of salads. You just kind of stick, so there won't actually be that much lettuce or spinach, whatever you're working with, underneath. It's all plumped up by mashed potatoes.
Well, so it's just the surface.
Yes, it's just the surface, and that's a good way to sort of sum up a lot of these tricks. It's that below the surface, the fake stuff is going on. So, for example, you take the turkeys that are bloody inside because they're not going to cook them the full amount of time, which is a huge pain. So, yeah, the turkeys will be basically raw, but they look good on the outside.
Well, are there any rules, I mean, either officially or even ethically, that need to be followed for food shoots? Or can food stylists pretty much use anything?
Well, they can't use anything. I mean, truth in advertising applies. So, for example, if they're doing a shoot for Breyers Ice Cream, they have to use the actual ice cream. But if there's toppings, for example, a cherry, maybe they would use a cherry tomato because they happen to have that on hand. So as long as the core product that's being sold is the real deal, anything else goes. And then, of course, those are for commercial shoots, but for more editorial shoots in magazines, anything goes for sure, because that's just more about making something look good. And because you're not pushing a product, there's not the same ethical standards to adhere to.
How about drinks? You mentioned coffee. A substitute for that would be soy sauce. But how about alcohol? You know, those beautiful looking drinks with the glistening glasses, precipitation beating down the sides.
Yeah, of course. So they don't ever use real alcohol, unless, of course, it's being advertised. But if it's just sort of your stock photo of a martini, there's not going to be any vodka in that, because that would be a horrible waste. So the main thing they pay attention to are those details you mentioned, sort of the condensation, the drip, the frost. Some interesting techniques are to use spray-on deodorant to frost the beer glass. For coffee, in terms of getting sort of bubbles around the rim, they use pipe soap.
And then to salt a margarita rim, they put Vaseline, so it's extra durable. Things like that.
How easily we are fooled. I mean, do you feel like a sucker after finding out some of these tricks?
I mean, I think I just feel a little grossed out, to be honest, especially the one about glue as in cereal for the milk.
Oh.
I can't look at cereal photos anymore. So I just kind of feel it changes things that are supposed to look delicious. When you sort of get under the skin and know the secrets, all of a sudden these ads have the opposite effect where you actually want to throw up because you're imagining ingesting glue.
You mean like Elmer's white glue, that kind of thing?
Elmer's white glue, or another popular milk substitute is a hair product from the 70s or 80s, a men's hair cream called Wild Root, and it looks like sunscreen.
Well, I was reading some of the comments about your article, and it was very interesting to see how some people looked at these tactics, you know, either as fraud, misrepresentation, but others not surprised at all and would even prefer to have food ads doctored to look perfect.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess that's a really personal thing. We don't seem to come down on it as hard as we do, for example, photoshopping women's bodies in magazines. I mean, I think most people think that's a bad practice that sort of sends a wrong message and creates all these societal issues. But with food, I think because it is food and because we all see food in real life, I mean, we know. We don't usually buy something because it looks delicious in an ad, most of us. I mean, we all go to restaurants. We all go to grocery stores. We have a pretty good idea of what things look like. So I don't think there's the same sense of feeling duped.
Well, food photography is really a big part of social media, especially on Instagram. So I'm wondering if any of these tactics might start being used outside of the professional settings.
That's a good question, which I hadn't thought about it, but you know, I think a lot of the social media food photography is in the moment. The whole thing is that it's fast. You're at a restaurant, you shoot your food before you eat it, and then, you know, the plate's gone. So I don't know if people are really going to start carrying around, you know, lipstick in their purse to kind of put on a strawberry that doesn't look red enough. I would be surprised unless there's sort of a paid component. For the average person, I don't know how practical it is.
Angelina Chapin is the blog's editor at The Huffington Post and a contributor to The Guardian, where you'll find her article detailing the secrets of food photography. Check out the photos of fake food. They look weirdly delicious. And there's a link at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Dolce & Gabbana, the Italian fashion house known for underwear-inspired lace, satin dresses, and clingy silhouettes, recently unveiled a new line of luxury hijabs and abayas for Muslim women. Smart move if you follow Fortune magazine's prediction that Muslim consumers will spend an estimated $484 billion on clothing and footwear by 2019. Virginia spoke to Aliyah Khan, chairwoman of the Islamic Fashion and Design Council, via Skype from Dubai, and she asked her if the new line of hijabs from a luxury brand is a meaningful moment for the fashion world.
I think it's very meaningful. I think what it does is it highlights the importance of this market. As you might know, it's a $500 billion market. It's got the spending power that's slightly second to mainstream fashion, only by a little bit. Mainstream fashion is estimated to have a spending power of about $625 billion. So when you look at it that way, you wonder why people didn't get into it, you know, much earlier. Dolce & Gabbana made a very smart move. They acknowledged a very important part of the fashion industry, the modest wear industry. It's not necessarily always a religious thing. Yes, you do find more of the, I think the number one consumer is probably the Muslim consumer. You've also got a secondary market, which is the Christian and the Jewish consumer. But then you've got the mainstream modest wear consumer who just wants to, live by that lifestyle. And so, yes, I think it's a very smart move.
Dolce & Gabbana is a very high-end fashion house, though, intended for people with means. So do you think this trend is going to trickle down to the more affordable brands?
Well, I think it should. I think that the designers would be wise to not overlook the more mass market, if you will. That's where a lot of the spending is happening anyway. But you know, having said that, there's a lot of affluence in this market. The consumers are, if you look at their demographics, they're affluent, well-educated. You know, they come from very strong income households, and they have certain demands. And the absolute sort of the bottom line to this that will determine the success of it is the actual designs themselves.
Well, at least here the reputation has been that we've heard about a lot of Muslim women that they may cloak themselves in basic black, but underneath they've spent a lot of money on designer clothing. What do you think that focus means if suddenly things on the outside are looking, let's say, lacier, sunnier, more patterned? What do you actually think of the designs themselves?
I think the designs are good. Look, in all honesty, I think they've kind of had mixed reviews, to be very honest. And I think a little bit more of the market study would do them well. It's one thing to get into this market, but it's another thing to actually get embraced by this market. It's a very loyal consumer that you're looking at. They've committed to this for life, and they're not going anywhere. They're looking for this type of product, so you might as well get it right so that they're pleased with you from the get-go.
Well, you are an example of that cosmopolitan woman based in Dubai, but you grew up in the U.S. and Canada, lived in L.A. So you, as a young, fashionable Muslim woman, was shopping difficult for you?
Shopping is always difficult, I think, for women that that choose the modest way of life. You know, we've had to, for a long time, sort of resort to layering, which was, you know, if you find that perfect dress, but the sleeves are just not long enough, or even sleeveless, or, you know, not the length is not full, you would have to sort of get a little bit creative, and you'd have to find some things to wear underneath to layer your outfit with. And that was time consuming, and it was quite tedious, and sometimes it could take about a week and a half to 2 weeks to find that perfect outfit, whereas our counterparts in the mainstream fashion world were going in, picking up their stuff, and, you know, and feeling lucky every time. Our council's changing that quite a bit. We've come up with a program called the Pret-a-Cover program. Pret-a-Cover is off of Pret-a-Porter, which is ready to wear. So we've called it the Ready to Cover program. And we're talking to retailers around the world about opening up a Pret-a-Cover department. So where you would have a couture department or activewear department, now you would have a Pret-a-Cover department where women are guaranteed to come in and shop with success without having to feel the frustration of having to layer and whatnot. So yes, it was challenging, but it is rapidly changing.
Of course, there is a lot of Islamophobia in U.S. and in Europe. Just last week, a woman in an abaya was verbally attacked at a rally for Donald Trump running for president. Banning headscarves in France has been controversial. You know, appearing Muslim can be a liability. Do you think the fashion world can do anything to change that perception?
So I think, again, it's about just, you know, stepping into reality and getting away from your television sets for a little while and going out there and meeting people. And, you know, we can all speak the same language, but in different ways, I guess, would be a good way of putting it. You know, we don't always have to look and act and behave and talk in the same way in order for us to accept each other. It's an exciting world that we live in, and it would be such a shame if you shut anybody out because of certain perceptions or even fears that are fabricated in you. They're definitely not real fears, because I'm sure many people have not even had firsthand experiences on who these people are.
Well, beyond the perception, let's look at the business. I mean, the cynic could think Dolce & Gabbana, known for this kind of, you know, Sicilian Catholic meets Fellini movie kind of style, is just looking at profits in the Muslim world, that it's not about design or inclusion. What do you think? Does the intent of the brand matter in this case?
Well, look, let's go easy on them. I mean, it's a starting place, right? I mean, at the end of the day, they are a business and they're entitled to make money. And if they see that this is a market with a huge opportunity for them, I applaud them. You know, they took that step and perhaps they would see themselves as someone that took a little bit of a risk, because there's that image thing too with Dolce & Gabbana too, right? So they stepped away from their comfort zone and they said, we're going to embrace this consumer, because fine, fair enough. If they felt it was going to be a moneymaker for themselves, good for them, and more power to them. At the end of the day, everyone's talking about it, and it's quite it's quite the sort of the news these days. If you open up any paper or any magazine, you'll be hearing about Dolce & Gabbana's hijab and abaya collection, and that talk is changing perceptions. So whether that was their intent or not, it is what's sort of resulting in this move, and I think we need to commend them for that.
That was Virginia's earlier conversation with Aliyah Khan, the chairwoman of the Islamic Fashion and Design Council. We've got a link to Dolce & Gabbana's new line, plus a selection of Instagram accounts that highlight modest fashion. You'll find it all on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, the heroin crisis hits home. We're going to hear from a documentary filmmaker about the opioid crisis on Cape Cod, and Virginia speaks to a New Hampshire woman who's painting portraits of young people who have died of overdoses. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Soft sand beaches, clam shacks, and weather-worn shingled houses, Cape Cod is a slice of paradise for tourists and vacationers, and it's flooded with cheap heroin. Across the country, opioid-related deaths have quadrupled since 2001. New England has been especially hard hit. On the Cape alone, 85% of crime is opiate-related.
People come here to vacation, think it's a wonderful place. It's the worst place to be at right now. Everybody's dying left to right.
Down on the Cape, there's really, like, nothing to do, like, at all. Like, you either work and you're normal, or you do drugs.
A new documentary from Oscar-winning filmmaker Stephen Okazaki shows us the other Cape, the Dunkin' Donuts parking lots, public restrooms, and smoke-filled apartments where opiate addicts score, use, rationalize, and talk candidly about their inability to overcome addiction. Heroin, Cape Cod, USA, is a documentary now available on HBO Go, and director Stephen Okazaki joined Virginia to talk about the film.
You follow 8 young people with a heroin habit. Many of them were first hooked on legal painkillers. Marissa, one of the characters, given Vicodin after she got her wisdom tooth pulled. Another in a motorcycle accident, given painkillers. Jessica, her face slashed up in an accident by a drunk driver. Here is, I think it's Ariana, remembering her first time.
I sniffed it and, like, the response happened in my brain. It was like I found, like, the love of my life, the other missing piece. Like, everything finally made sense.
The love of her life. Is that something that you heard commonly from the people that you followed?
Yeah. And she, she went on to say it was, the feeling was better than love. It was better than sex. It was better than children. And she had 2 children. And she, at the time of the film, when we were filming her, she had 3 years clean. And she was staying clean for her kids. And then the drug, it's very hard for people to understand how powerful the drug is and how powerful the pull to it is. I think, we all, everybody has some kind of addiction. I don't know whether it's chocolate chip ice cream or, watching a TV show or something. But, it's hard to fathom. I mean, and I think, you know, it's easy to blame the users as well, but I think, you know, you can take someone with the exact same profile, you know, as one of these kids, and they, you know, they would not have a heroin problem. Mm. It's, you know, as they say in the film several times, it's a disease. It's something that just kids are vulnerable to it, and particularly at that age. I mean, I think taking up heroin at 14 or 16 is not the same kind of process as deciding to, you know, try it at the age of 30. I mean, you're so vulnerable. You're not getting along with your parents, and you don't know what you want to do with your life. You're feeling sort of isolated. You want to, you know, and something comes along that's going to block out that pain. But at the same time, yeah, at least half of the kids in the film were at least introduced by, you know, essentially by their doctors giving them prescriptions. And, you know, two of them were in serious car accidents. So they went home with, you know, a couple hundreds of pills. And you use those pills, you know, for 6 months, 7 months, and it can easily become a problem.
Well, she, Ariana, like others, she'd been through several treatment programs. She'd been to sober houses and rehabs and survived nearly ODing more than once with the help of the drug Narcan. Let's hear a little bit more about Narcan.
The doctors told me to stop a couple times, like after the first couple times I've overdosed. I just kept dying. Because I always thought, like, they're going to bring me back. They'll bring me back. They'll hit me with Narcan. I'm fine. They'll bring me back.
The Narcan is kind of a Band-Aid for the people that overdose in the short term. But again, it's just a Band-Aid. That is just treating a symptom. These people are back on the street 45 minutes later doing the exact same thing. So you haven't actually fixed the problem whatsoever.
All the times I OD'd, I'd get right out of the hospital and I'd get high right after. I'd get high in the hospital parking lot.
That's a clip from Heroin, Cape Cod, USA. It's a new HBO documentary made by my guest, Stephen Okazaki. He's an Oscar-winning documentary film director. We heard a little bit from Marissa, one of the characters, along with Dr. Craig Cornwall there. You know, as many states and municipalities are putting Narcan in the hands of first responders and parents. We just heard from the doctor there, just a Band-Aid. Do you think addicts believe that they are bulletproof?
Well, I think that obviously Narcan has saved, you know, thousands. I have, you know, no idea how many lives. But it has, at the same time, emboldened kids to thinking they're that someone will just, you know, Narcan them. You know, but you can get so loaded, someone can Narcan you over and over, and it won't bring you back. When you have addicts, there's always sort of a workaround. How can I make this work for me? You know, once you're addicted, there are no simple solutions. For me, just observing it, I mean, it's just, you know, you can see how helpless people feel and how helpless their families are to help them. But, you know, much of the problem now, I mean, I think it's been different in different times, although there have been numerous attempts to commercialize opiates since the beginning of opiates. At the turn of the 19th century, Bayer, at the same time they were introducing aspirin and giving out free samples of aspirin, were also... Bayer gave heroin its name, and it was also offered free as free samples, even to children, particularly to children and women, when it was introduced. So it's finally succeeded. Opiates have been commercialized, and they're so available. And it seems to me that's the place to attack the problem, is that supply.
Let's hear a little bit about the impact on families, which comes across very strongly in this film. One of the young women you talked to, Danielle, says, "Anyone with my last name, I've hurt the most." There's a support group made up of parents, mostly mothers, I notice. And here are a few clips from meetings. And let me just remark that they were not played together in the film.
If my kid had some other disease that was as dangerous to him as his addiction, people would be bringing casseroles, you know? But I haven't gotten any casserole.
I knew I played a part in it. You know, I was giving him money. I was enabling him to not have to go to work or, you know, whatever, like, you know, by buying the things, paying for his cell phone, doing all those things, I was giving him the money to go out and use his money for drugs.
Just so many different things in there. The kids say that themselves, I was happy. I wasn't a depressed kid or I wasn't molested. I was active in sports. You know, so in other words, none of these old notions of why people want to obliterate themselves. And it's not about socioeconomic status or education. Is opioid addiction a whole new ballgame than, you know, what you witnessed back in San Francisco during the heroin days? Is it just a new thing altogether?
Well, I think it is very different. When I was doing Black Tar Heroin in San Francisco in 1996, 1997, the kids that I came across had these backgrounds that were, you know, nightmarish. The sexual and physical abuse and level of neglect. You thought, well, heroin's an option for them. You know, as one thing that might, you know, sort of block that out of their heads for a while. Now, you know, which is not to say that, you know, the kids in Cape Cod, USA, don't have issues, but it's like, you know, what typical 18-year-old doesn't have a lot of drama going on in their head that they want to, you know, get rid of or solve or something. I think it is really different. There's a different kind of just, you know, seeking that good high sort of culture that, you know, that the culture has somehow enabled, where kids are using alcohol or marijuana. And from lots of kids, you know, they stop there. And for others, they want a better high. And they start talking and someone says, have you tried this or have you tried that? And, you know, I think in past times, heroin's had this very different sort of aura, this sort of, you know, as the, you know, scariest, most deadly, most addictive of the drugs. And obviously, because, you know, your first attempt at it doesn't have to be going down to the corner, and you can just go over to the medicine cabinet, you know, and get, you know, somebody's old prescription that they haven't thrown out, the leftovers from somebody's, you know, broken bones, or even a toothache, you can get opiates. So the access to it is very different.
All of the addicts that we meet in your film are clearly struggling. But there's this one, Marissa, to me, just so heartbreaking. Obviously very smart, a little cocky. She makes clear that she never steals. You know, she dances at a strip club. She works as a prostitute to support her habit. But none of that saves her from shame.
I'm ashamed, and I think everybody sees my arms. I feel like everyone sees them everywhere I go. They're always looking, or like people at Dunkin' Donuts even look. I feel like everyone's looking at me. Everybody knows. You know, I'm a good girl. Like, I don't know why I do this to myself. You just become so lost. And I just don't want to feel that pain. So that's why I get high. And I know people, you know, that's just an excuse, but f you, I don't want to feel it.
And that's Marissa. She is one of the addicts that is profiled in the film Heroin, Cape Cod, USA. It's a new HBO documentary directed by my guest, Stephen Okazaki, who's an Oscar-winning documentary director. That's one of the things that just really strikes me over and over again in this film, the kind of self-perception, the kind of honesty about who they are. Like, they're addicts. This is what they do. This is what they love. I'm just wondering how it struck you as a filmmaker.
Well, I think you feel the tragedy when you have someone like Marissa, who is so smart, you know, so articulate, funny, you know, passionate about life, and you think she's one of these people. If you met her, didn't know she was an addict, you'd think she could do anything. I should hire her to run my company, or you really feel the possibilities for her are sort of endless, but she's gone this other way. And she's 23 years old, and she's sort of the veteran user of the group. And we decided to use her as sort of the muse who comes in and out. She's not really part of the other people's stories, although she's well known. When we did her interview, she was not in Cape Cod. She had been part of that scene, but was working in a strip club in New Hampshire. But so we sort of had her as our sage coming in, sort of commenting on the lives of these newer users. And it was really, going through her transcripts, she could articulate any aspect of what addiction was, what it felt like, what someone goes through. She was so smart, except unfortunately for herself, she was really vulnerable. And when we were doing the film, she was on Suboxone and she was trying to not get high. She was using the chewing gum form of it. And but she had a boyfriend who was in jail, and when he got out, and then a few days later, Marissa overdosed and was gone. That was just a couple months ago.
You came to know these people, and not all turns out well for them, certainly. Now you're talking to the public about the film. You know, you're working with Governor Charlie Baker of Massachusetts. So what is it that you want to be saying to public policymakers or the public or healthcare workers after making this film?
Well, I think my goal as a filmmaker is, not political, not policy, really. I mean, my goal is to just put a human face on it. So when we talk about it, we don't just talk about numbers. We don't sort of stereotype who the addicts are, that we can put a human face on it. To me, the most powerful line in the film is when Marissa, who was on before, says, don't disrespect me. I could be your daughter. And I think that really is the theme of the film. I mean, it could be you. It could be someone really close to you. And so let's not just, walk by it. The governor of Massachusetts the film is very graphic. It's, uncensored. It's HBO, of course. Mm-hmm. But, he had no qualms putting his full support. And we just showed the film to the White House drug czar, and the White House is going to sponsor screening in a couple weeks. So I don't know. That part is sort of unexpected. But I think, our job is pretty much done. And I think the solutions are very difficult, but, it's so bad, people cannot avoid it anymore and have to pay attention to it. And if we can help eliminate it a little, that's great.
Stephen Okazaki is the director of the documentary Heroin, Cape Cod, USA, which is now available on HBO Go. We've got links to the film and a trailer at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Officials in New Hampshire estimate that the number of deaths due to drugs surpassed 400 by the end of 2015, or about one of every 3,000 people. And while the numbers are shocking, it is the human side of this crisis that one woman is now trying to highlight. When Anne-Marie Zanfania lost her daughter to a heroin overdose in 2014, she struggled to get through the next 6 months. Ultimately, she channeled her energy into a project that has helped other families cope with similar loss. Anne-Marie Zanfania is a New Hampshire-based artist who has begun painting portraits of those who have died because of drug overdoses in the state, and she joined Virginia in studio to talk about her daughter and the project.
You can tell me as much as you'd like to of this, but I'm looking at this portrait of your daughter, Jacqueline. Jacqueline, beautiful young woman. What happened to her?
She was beautiful, no doubt about it. And she knew it. But I think when she was younger, she was maybe struggling with behavioral issues that never got addressed, although I brought her to many doctors, psychiatrists, in counseling, out of counseling, her whole life. And I tried to get her into a rehab, but she wasn't ready. And I found out about almost maybe 9 months before she died that she was taking heroin. Mm-hmm. And we had a family intervention. I asked her to move out because she was having none of it, and she did. But we keep in touch because I always kept her cell phone on. And then she moved back home again, and things were going really well. She got a job, she got a new car, and a new boyfriend. We thought life is good. Right. We thought our prayers are answered. But it had been a difficult struggle, you know, because when you have a child that is on drugs, there's lots of other things you deal with.
Right.
You deal with the police. You deal with your own possessions. Where are they?
Yeah, I've heard a lot about that kind of thing.
And it's sad. But I went to, I'd been going to a therapist when, well, before Jackie overdosed the first time. And I had been grieving Jackie for that whole year before she died, because I know that if you take heroin, you usually die.
And she was lost to you, I guess, on some level anyway, if she's addicted.
Right. And the therapist, you know, was explaining to me that the brain chemistry changes totally. And that's something I think a lot of people don't understand. But I had that explained to me so that I could, you know, make some sense of what was going on.
So it felt more like a disease than a moral failing, which I think is what a lot of people get upset about, you know, that they think that somehow they failed, that it's not about brain chemistry and drugs answering an addiction.
Well, I knew it wasn't that. You know, we have a good family, a good support system. She was raised well and had, you know, whatever basically she wanted.
How old was she when she died?
She was 25.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So you started with her portrait, making her portrait. Did you plan on doing others at that time?
No.
How many have you done now?
I'm working on my sixth one.
Well, I'm looking at, you brought them in, and you're generous to bring them in for us to see them, but I'm just struck at how young, vibrant. I mean, obviously you're taking portraits of pictures that are, you know, people posing for them. They want to look good. How did you choose these subjects?
I met parents or wives or loved ones, and they got me a picture. Sometimes I can pull pictures off of Facebooks, because to do this, I put the original picture through a computer program.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out with color and the shape. And then I draw it and paint it.
Mm-hmm. You do the shading. They're very, if I can use the word, kind of Warholian. You know, there's not a lot of shading distinction, very bold kind of colors.
Well, it's called posterization.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm wondering, you know, as you're doing these portraits of these people, you may not have known them at all. What's going through your mind?
The pain of their family. My pain. It doesn't go away. But I feel like I'm bringing attention right now to the problem. And that's a mission of mine.
Mm, yeah.
Also, it helps the family members heal a little better, because it's not your regular portrait. This is a joyful painting because of the colors I choose. And so they have something that would make them happy.
The response here in New Hampshire and other places, some talk of policy changes, some talk of recovery centers, you know, getting tighter on fentanyl. What role does art play in this discussion of the heroin crisis?
Art brings attention. You see people here, even though they're brightly colored. These are all our children. And when you put a face to a statistic, I think it makes a big difference. This is not just number, you know, 300 that died. This is a person, someone who had a mother and a father, children, you never know. And we have to honor them. Something terrible happened to them, and they died from heroin. And I don't want to let Jackie die, you know. This keeps her with me. It keeps us with their families.
That was Virginia's conversation with Anne Marie Zanfania. Anne Marie is a New Hampshire-based artist who paints portraits of those who have died of drug overdoses in the state. You can see a photo of some of her work on our website. Thanks for spending some time with us today. We invite you to share what you heard with others. Go to wordofmouthradio.org for past episodes to listen to, post on social media, or email to friends. You can also subscribe to our podcast there or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us again next time for more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.